This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration is designed to prepare students to lead in the social sector by combining classroom learning with field education and five focused pathways. The final deadline for the program is April 1st. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork.
To stand before you tonight as your Democratic nominee.
Regardless of our past differences, this election is bigger than all of that.
The American Israel Public Affairs Committee, better known as AIPAC, spent a reported $22 million supporting pro-Israel candidates in yesterday's primary election.
All the issues are very important to me.
Pretty much everything on the ballot feels important right now.
Illinois, thank you. Thank you for your trust and your faith in me to carry out our agenda and carry it forward as your Democratic nominee for governor.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Susie Ahn, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday, so it's time to look back and break down the big stories of the week in our weekly news recap. We'll look at the results from Tuesday's primary election and the millions that made its way into Illinois campaigns from political PACs. A political newcomer gets impressive results in the 9th district, while a political comeback for Jesse Jackson Jr. falls short in the 2nd. Plus, city council votes to end a phase-out of the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers, while raising the downtown hotel tax to the highest in the nation.
Visitors booking hotels in downtown Chicago will soon be subject to the highest hotel tax in the nation.
The CHA Board of Commissioners naming Keith Pettigrew to take over the agency.
Former Dalton Mayor Tiffany Henyard is attempting to restart her political career, but not here in Illinois.
Well, Chicago City Council has decided to put a freeze on increasing wages for tipped workers.
I am really concerned because I make significantly more from tips than I would from a flat hourly wage.
We'll get into those stories and much more. Joining me at the table to help make sense of the week's news was Tom Shuba, senior public safety editor for WBEZ and the Chicago Sun-Times, Julie Bosman, Chicago bureau chief for the New York Times, and Fox 32 political correspondent Paris Schutz. We started by recapping the results from Tuesday's primary election.
There was so much hand-wringing over the gobs of special interest money that came in, and the big ones, AIPAC, groups tied to the AI industry and the crypto industry. And yet, the special interest that swept and had the best night was Governor J.B. Pritzker, who put in millions and millions through his PAC to support Juliana Stratton. One big, I think, exceeded expectations against a very well-financed and prepared candidate in Raja Krishnamoorthi, who had been looking to do this for a long time. But not only that, he won the race for comptroller. Margaret Croke was a candidate that he supported. He had endorsed Tony Preckwinkle. She drubbed Brendan Riley to become a fifth term Cook County Board president. And then, last but not least, the GOP candidate for governor, Darren Bailey. That's who he wanted to face. Ted Dabrowski, North Shore libertarian policy wonk, he might have been a little more nervous about. Darren Bailey, who he beat 4 years ago, not quite as nervous. So J.B. Pritzker, I think, proved to a lot of the pundits and the onlookers in the political class the day after that he's pretty much the boss of Illinois politics right now. He wins, he wields a lot of power, and will that get national Democratic Party leaders notice come 2028?
We are going to dive in deeper to some of those topics, especially money. But first, any surprises, standouts for you, Tom?
No, not beyond what Paris just said here. I think obviously Stratton winning was kind of the big news of the night, and So, yeah, I don't really have any
insights. Sure. Well, Julie, speaking of Stratton, she ran on an anti-Trump message, as many Democrats did. Did that clearly work in her favor?
I think it did. I think a few different things worked for her to get her over the finish line. Obviously, like Paris said, she had Governor Pritzker's endorsement and Governor Pritzker's money to help her. But she also, I think, had just enough name recognition and likability to convince voters. I think it's always tricky to read these races with lieutenant governors because they are, by definition, in a deputy position, sort of in the background. So I thought it was really interesting to see that she overcame what she needed to win that race.
Yeah, and looking closer at that, the money in that race, a lot of people thought this was Raja Krishnamoorthy's race to lose. The New York Times wrote about how the money he raised really showed the growing political influence of the Indian American community.
Yeah, it was a real moment. I think that, right now there are more than, I think, 6 Indian Americans in Congress, more than there ever has been. I think that a lot of people thought that he could do it, that he could win this primary. And I think across the country, the number of Indian American elected officials is about 300, which is an all-time high. And he was a pretty likable candidate on the stump. And, as anyone who was following him around saw, he kind of explained over and over again to Illinois voters how to say his name. Right. He used the Roger Christian Murphy line over and over, which was especially, cute on St. Patrick's Day weekend, as he was the only candidate in his race marching in the South Side Parade on Sunday. So I think that, it was a bit of a test, but it's just hard to go up against someone who is in some ways an incumbent because she was so closely tied to J.B. Pritzker.
But, we make the case of Pritzker's money, and he made the case because I asked him, I was like, are you any better than these big special interests that are coming and flooding these races? He says, well, guess what? She got outraised something like 3-1 by Raja Krishnamoorthy. So that it kind of puts her victory, it makes it even more impressive. She was outspent and she won 44 out of 50 wards in Chicago. She won most of the counties in the state. And I know it meant a lot to Krishnamoorthy to become, the first Asian American senator in Illinois. But, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. He got dinged during the campaign for the contribution he had gotten from, I can't remember his name, but an Asian American executive of Palantir. Palantir, of course, being that controversial company that has all those contracts with DHS. So he was forced to kind of give that back, and that became a campaign issue.
And I'll just clarify, South Asian.
South
Senator.
Asian, I'm sorry. Yes, South Asian.
Well, I want to turn now to
Tammy Duckworth. What am I thinking? Of course.
Right. We know what you meant.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I want to turn now to the 9th district. A political newcomer, Kat Abu Ghazaleh, came within 3.5 points of Evanston Mayor Daniel Biss to replace longtime Representative Jan Schakowsky. Paris, she was sort of a long shot candidate in the beginning. What does this say about the race that she ran?
I have to say, coming in second by 3 points is an impressive showing by someone that's not from the district, someone that's young, someone that relied on this new kind of influencing TikTok.
Yeah.
She's a very talented rhetorician. She knows how to elaborate her points. But I do think it's score one for the traditional style of campaigning, especially in the 9th congressional district, where you've got all these very entrenched Democratic groups in Edgewater and Rogers Park and Evanston. And Daniel Biss, he is very progressive. He's not that far away from Kat Abu Ghazaleh on the issues, but he's the guy that got endorsed by Jan Schakowsky. He's the guy that's been mayor and state senator. He's the guy that went to all the groups and shook the hands and did that kind of old fashioned retail campaigning, and that's what made the difference. Still, so is this the sea change that we're waiting for in politics, the new generation taking over? Well, the new generation still doesn't vote in the same numbers that the senior citizens vote, although they did better than Gen X. So it's like senior citizens were like the number one group, and 18 to 24, 25 to 34, they did pretty well. It's that group in the middle that doesn't do so well. So again, She had a good showing, but it's a sign that the old-fashioned ways of politicking and campaigning still are the ones that are the most rewarded.
Yeah. I did wonder what her ground game was like. Yeah. I happened to live in the ninth, and my doorbell rang rather frequently from canvassers.
Crowded field.
Very crowded. My mailbox is still recovering from all the big glossy mailers stuffed in there. But Laura Fine's canvassers came to my door. Daniel Biss's canvassers came to my door. And I didn't get any from any other candidates. So,
wow.
And, you know, she really needed to do absolutely overwhelmingly well in, you know, the 48th, the 49th, the 47th. And I think she just fell short, but it still was a pretty impressive showing for someone who is as young and as new to Illinois as she was.
Yeah, absolutely. And to think also that Laura Fine had a lot of money in that race as well.
AIPAC. I mean, that was AIPAC. And AIPAC became a huge issue in that, as Julie knows, I mean, it was a massive issue for voters in that race, and AIPAC made bets on every single one of these four congressional races, and they won two of them, two out of four.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I guess kind of sticking with that money, the governor, who is Jewish, had harsh words for the millions that pro-Israeli group AIPAC spent on Illinois' election. What do you make of that, you know, given that Pritzker also spent millions on this election, Julie?
Well, I think it just shows how AIPAC is changing, not just in its image before voters, but before Democrats who are in office. They're just increasingly seeing it as a right-wing organization tied to President Trump, tied to values associated with President Trump and his voters, as some elected officials would say. So I think that there's just more and more distancing happening from AIPAC. And in the 9th District, I do wonder whether the money that AIPAC poured into that race for Laura Fine did more harm than good to her. You know, I stood outside the polls and talked to people who were voting in Skokie, in Evanston, and a lot of people said, I didn't like that AIPAC was involved. I didn't like, you know, I like Laura Fine, but I didn't like that AIPAC was supporting her. So you have to wonder what effect they had there and whether it backfired as it did in New Jersey.
Right. It was interesting. It seemed to play well in some races, but definitely not there. You know, Illinois was flooded with money from outside political groups, also known as super PACs. Why us? Why here in Illinois?
Well, if you look at the groups like AIPAC and AI and crypto, it's because they want something from the folks that go to Congress. So I don't think we can kind of surmise that AI and crypto, these emerging industries, they don't want regulations. I mean, they want folks that will go to Congress and be really light in terms of how they regulate these new industries so they can make as much money as they want. What AIPAC traditionally wants is Congress people that will vote to fund and provide defense support to Israel without condition, and that position is becoming increasingly more controversial in the Democratic Party, but also in the Republican Party. I think as you see folks just get critical of Israel's role in the war in Iran, and so I think that AIPAC, if this was going to be a test of where the Democratic Party was going to stand on Israel, it's pretty muddled result here. I don't think we have a clear answer on that. I think it's just kind of mixed in the Democratic Party. And I don't think it gets better for AIPAC by the day as the Iran war drags on.
Absolutely.
And more people die.
We saw a lot of the old guard, I guess, retiring this election cycle. Tom, does it feel like a real generational shift happening in this election?
Yeah, I think, from the older boomers who I think younger politicians are increasingly critical of how they're dealing with Trump and Republicans. Juliana Stratton, Daniel Biss, LaShawn Ford, all of whom are, pretty good at dealing with the media, which I think, people like us who work in the media, LaShawn Ford, Daniel Biss are people who pick up the phone, who will talk to us. They're also really good with their political messaging. Stratton was really great with her messaging. I think she had, this viral commercial of F Donald Trump that really made waves. They also were really clear in policies that I think were pretty progressive, right? Stratton was straightforward about, hey, I want to abolish ICE. And Raja kind of went to the right of that. I'm going to abolish Trump's ICE, right? And so, I do think this is going to be a sea change. And maybe these are people who are going to be fighters if in November the Democrats can, you know, take some control in Congress.
But, you know, if I could capitalize on what Tom just said, it kind of feels like in the congressionals, the new old guard. Because if you look at the folks that won, many of them were endorsed by the folks leaving. So LaShawn Ford was who Danny Davis, he was a Danny Davis protege. And there were folks in that race that were newcomers or neophytes or more progressive, and they didn't win. LaShawn Ford did. And then if you look at it in the ninth, Daniel Biss, he is progressive, but he was also kind of the institutional candidate. He was the one endorsed by Jan Schakowsky. And in the second congressional district, Donna Miller, who was a recipient of AIPAC money, so she wasn't as far to the left as some other candidates, she won. And I think Robin Kelly, that was her, and I don't think she formally endorsed it, but that I get the sense that that's who she wanted to replace her. That's Robin Kelly's seat. And then Melissa Bean in the eighth, someone that's kind of a blue dog centrist Democrat that's already been in Congress. So if you look, you know, a lot of some of the more centrist, like the James Carville type of Democrats nationally, looked at this and said, hey, if you think the Democratic Party is going the way of the squad, and that's the way to take on Trump, you know, the squad being like Rashida Tlaib and AOC, you got to think again, look what happened in Illinois. It's non quote unquote squad type candidates. It's more traditional Democrats.
Right. Yeah. Well, speaking of some of these endorsements, Paris, a controversial Senate endorsement by the late Jesse Jackson Sr., came into play just days before the election. This was, you know, this is some election drama. What was this about?
So this was the Stratton campaign the weekend before, last weekend, made a campaign statement saying that, oh, they, by the way, they had the posthumous endorsement of the late Reverend Jesse Jackson, that he endorsed Juliana Stratton. Some of Jackson's children, Jonathan Jackson, came out and said, whoa, we didn't, you know, he didn't endorse anybody. This process, he had started this process, but he was sick and he was ailing and he died. And out of respect, you know, we didn't endorse in the primary, especially with a primary with two African-American women. That's just not what he would want to do. But then they kind of revised it more because, you know, it seems like this was kind of a miscommunication on the part of Rainbow Push. Mm-hmm. There was a sample ballot that Reverend Jackson and Yusef, his son, filled out that said the endorsements of Reverend Jackson, and it had Juliana Stratton. And someone at Rainbow Push gave it to the Stratton campaign and said, go spread it. And Yusef eventually, after all these revisions and statements, came out and acknowledged that this was a miscommunication, that someone did leak that ballot to the Stratton campaign and made them believe that it was okay to go out and say that. And so it doesn't seem like an it first seemed like maybe an unforced error on the Stratton campaign's part, but I think at the end of the day it was a miscommunication.
Yeah. You know, what a time for that to happen, but I guess it didn't play
it
too much.
It certainly didn't. It certainly, you know, one might have thought, is this going to, you know, are some voters going to be offended that the man just died, he's a legend, and you're just capitalizing on him to try and win an election? But it certainly didn't seem to make a difference.
Yeah, for sure. Well, sticking with the Jackson family, Julie, a lot of people thought Jesse Jackson's legacy might win the second district for his son, Jesse Jackson Jr., but in the end, voters didn't seem to buy his redemption story.
Yeah, this was a fascinating race. Jesse Jackson Jr., who really had a spectacular fall when he was in Congress. He had this multi-layered scandal involving, you know, using campaign funds for, you know, memorabilia and, you know, a Rolex. And then, of course, he talked about his mental health issues. He had marital woes. So I think in the end, there was just too much going on for voters to be able to forget about that, especially when they had another candidate in Donna Miller, who a lot of voters saw as a pretty straightforward public servant, someone who really didn't have a lot of negatives. And she won pretty handily. And again, because of the way that the district is drawn, you know, Jesse Jackson Jr. did quite well on the South Side. But then it winds down to Kankakee and other places where he's not really going to have the greatest support. So that was a tough one. And it was very interesting just to see whether he could overcome the scandal of, you know, years ago, but it was still obviously pretty fresh in a lot of voters' minds.
Definitely.
It did also seem that, you know, Jesse has kind of lost a bit of his dazzle, right? Before the scandal, he was this attractive, young, well-spoken politician, you know, the son of political royalty, essentially. And he didn't seem to have that as much this time. And it was really evident, I think, in his concession speech.
That's an interesting observation. And it's almost like a low profile, but still putting yourself out there. I don't know. There was definitely something, a personality shift this time around that I noticed. Of course, the next vote will be the general election in November. And that could look a little different if Mayor Johnson has his way. Tom, he's proposing what he's calling democracy zones around polling places. How would that even work?
Yeah, so he tried to get this passed before the primaries, and he wasn't able to get it up for a vote. And he's tethered this to the late Jesse Jackson, seemingly to try to, you know, drum up support for it and make it difficult for people to oppose. But so this would create kind of no ice zones, similar to what he did during Midway Blitz, that would extend 100 feet beyond where electioneering is typically allowed at polling places. And it would go after doxing, you know, political related doxing, kind of exposing people's personal information. And it would try to change building code violations around mailboxes to ensure that vote by mail is protected. So we'll see what this winds up being. The mayor has thrown out executive orders and, you know, different proposals that relate to kind of protecting against ice, bolstering protections. There's concerns, I think, with this proposal specifically.
How enforceable it will even be.
Yeah, how enforceable it will be, what position it could put local police officers in if they're called to a polling place. How do they deal with ice, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, ice is standing a couple feet too close. How do you measure the zone? So, you know, I'm not sure entirely what to make of it as we move forward.
Let's not forget that back in fall, what the major concern was from immigration advocates, from public officials, was that March 17th would be a primary that was hugely disrupted by ICE's presence, by their second surge in Chicago, and that never came to be.
All right, so let's turn our attention now to City Hall. Chicago City Council reversed course this week, voting to end a phase-out of the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers. Julie, refresh our memories on this issue.
So this is an issue that was a real showdown between Mayor Johnson and the City Council. And this week, I think that what the council did really shows the battle between how the council sees its interests, in some ways more pro-business, pro-corporate, and Mayor Johnson tends to side more with workers.
Yeah. Well, this was seen as one of Mayor Brandon Johnson's most significant wins. The mayor actually discussed this on In the Loop on Monday. Let's take a listen.
At a time in which affordability is like top of mind for the entire country, Democrats have to pay attention to what the voters of the city of Chicago are calling for, and quite frankly, what voters across America are expecting from leadership at a time in which it's becoming increasingly harder to afford to live in this city, to live in cities across America. Cutting the wages of workers is just, that is antithetical to what we're trying to build when we talk about safe and affordable communities.
Well, Julie, the mayor's promising to veto this vote. How damaging do you think this is to him?
I think it shows the tensions between the mayor and the council. 34 votes are needed to override. The vote to freeze this phase out was 30-18. So I think that, look, it shows that Johnson doesn't have a council that will do whatever he wants. And he's going to have to use that veto when he sees fit.
You know, and so what happens now is that this reversal passed with 30 votes. They need four more. to get a veto-proof majority. And so the restaurant industry, which is leading the charge to try and reverse this sub-minimum wage hike, they're working now on getting those four, twisting some arms and figuring out if they can get that. And I have to say, I mean, I don't think it's universally felt among tipped workers that this is a good thing. I think there are some tipped workers that say, A, you know, agree with the restaurant point of view of like, well, now it's caused layoffs and cutting costs elsewhere. Yeah. And B, you know, there were tipped workers that made the case that like, look, you know, people tip me if I'm a bartender or whatever, knowing that I make, you know, sub minimum wage. And now if they think that, oh, well, they all make a certain wage, maybe I won't tip anymore. Right. And so I think that it's very interesting how the restaurant industry organized and was able to literally get an ordinance passed that reversed an ordinance that already passed. I don't know how many times I've ever seen that. So now that if they can get four more votes and override the mayor's veto, that would be tremendously damaging to the mayor.
Definitely. And it's just another example. I mean, these key initiatives that he has that are really tethered to his agenda.
Right.
You're talking about the hemp issue, the head tax issue, mm-hmm. the curfew issue. You really see the council is going right up against his key initiatives, and you're seeing him kind of struggle to fight them. And so, I mean, this is just another example, and he's had to flex his veto power more and more as a result.
So. Yeah, let's not forget that he didn't even pass a budget. The budget enacted was the city council alternative budget that he said, I'm not signing it. I'm not veto. I'm just doing nothing on this.
Yeah. Well, Mayor Johnson took another political hit this week. The Chicago Housing Authority Board appointed a new head over his objections. Paris, tell us about Keith Pettigrew.
Well, Keith Pettigrew comes to the job with a lot of experience, having done this, I believe, in D.C.
Yes, in D.C.
So it sounds like he's someone with qualifications, but it's certainly split the CHA board. And as Mick Dumke wrote in Block Club, this is notable not necessarily for who got the position, but for who didn't get the position. Mayor Johnson clearly wanted Walter Burnett, the former 27th Ward Alderman, to get this job. And it does appear that there was some kind of handshake deal where Burnett would retire early from his seat. He was a staunch ally of the mayor. Retired early. The mayor put together a quote-unquote community process for his replacement. And oh my gosh, it settled on his son, Walter Redmond Burnett. It's just amazing how that happens to take over as alderman. And the idea was that Walter Burnett Sr. would then kind of coast into this role, which is a well-paying role as the head of the CHA. And not everyone on the CHA board was into this or involved in the CHA, saying, wait a second, we need someone that's actually run a big housing authority before. Pettigrew seems to fit that pedigree more than Burnett. Although, let's make mention of the fact that Burnett grew up in public housing, so he's very close to public housing. There were some concerns, too, about conflicts of interest with Burnett. Mm-hmm. I mean, he has property. Is he going to divest from that? Is there going to be a conflict of interest? And so now, just today, I'm getting emails from other CHA board members saying they want to re-vote on this, that they thought this process was behind closed doors. Right. It needs to have more public meetings. It sounds like, you know, a mayoral-backed maybe effort to try and get Burnett in there, even though the board went the other way. So stay tuned on that.
Yeah, absolutely. And in other appointments, Johnson picked Kenya Merritt to head up the city's cultural affairs department. She's had that role on an interim basis since October, when the mayor's handpicked cultural commissioner resigned under allegations of bullying and sexual harassment. The mayor also fired a staffer. Paris, this is big today. Tell us what happened with Deputy Mayor Garion Gatewood.
Yeah, I was going to say not just a staffer, but the Deputy Mayor for Public Safety, Garion Gatewood. So Garion Gatewood was the person that was out front after like the mass shooting in the Loop. And he was the liaison between the mayor's office and the police department. He was kind of driving the policy of the overall crime reduction political policy, the strategy. You know, how much do we involve violence intervention? How much do we interact with the police department? And there's some tension here because Gatewood didn't go quietly. They fired him yesterday. They just said they want to go in a different direction. And he was angry. And he came and he spoke with us and he said that he doesn't understand why they fired him. He thought when you bring the crime rate down to the murder rate to the lowest level in 30 years, that should count as a success, not saying that he had everything to do with that. So why would you go in a different direction? B, you know, there's some, if you read between the lines of what he said, it sounds like there was significant tension between he and the mayor or the mayor's top staffers, the chief of staff and the political director, Jason Lee, in that Gatewood would be the guy out there to honor the fallen officers and firefighters like Altman this week. He would be out there after the Loop mass shooting. He would be the guy mm-hmm. from the mayor's office, the face of it. And it seemed like that he said, what he said to me was, there's a culture in this office of when you try to hold people accountable, you have a target on your back. I read that to mean that he thought the mayor should be out there more, honoring fallen officers, mm-hmm. out there after the Loop shooting.
Yeah.
Not just taking credit for the good things, but out there during the bad things to say, I'm in charge here. We're going to figure this out. And it was Gatewood that would be out there, not the mayor.
Right.
And from what I've talked to from sources is there was a significant tension there.
Yeah.
Now, there's been other reporting sources in the mayor's office saying, well, there was a hostile work environment under Gatewood.
Yeah.
I haven't corroborated that on documentation. I haven't seen an EEOC complaint. I asked to see HR. They wouldn't show me anything like that to corroborate that. So, Tom's been talking to some folks on this too.
Murmurings.
Well, I mean, I will say that this rolled out very strangely, right? These aren't the first firings or exits under Mayor Johnson. You know, obviously, people's phones, Paris, my phone, start ringing, buzzing yesterday in the afternoon. Hey, Gatewood's out. Also, another official in this office, Manuel Whitfield, also fired. So we start hearing this. We're trying to figure out what happened. The mayor's office says, oh, well, we're not going to comment on personnel issues, but here's the temporary replacement. As this keeps unfolding, the Sun-Times, Fran Spielman, Sophie Sherry, we start hearing from sources, well, yeah, there's this hostile work environment. There are other issues. Gatewood's denying it. They're putting up current employees to deny it. Very, very strange. Also very strange that, you know, as recently as this week, we're seeing the mayor's office tout the work of Gatewood.
Right.
Right?
He did.
And like Paris said, we saw record lows in violence. Gatewood is directly like kind of this liaison with not only the police department, but with the violence intervention community, which we have invested in heavily and which the mayor credits greatly with the reduction in violence. So I think, like Paris said, we're going to have to get some paperwork. We're going to have to get some real information to corroborate what exactly was happening. Because, you know, I've heard from sources about, you know, disputes between the mayor and Gatewood. Again, not corroborated with paperwork, anything underlying that. But, you know, there's a lot of murmuring and rumors and discussion happening.
Yeah, but let's go back to what the mayor said. What was it, like a year ago, where he said something to the effect of, my biggest mistake was I should have gotten rid of people that, quote unquote, weren't on the team earlier, right away. And there have been high profile firings in this office where people were like, what the heck happened here? And it does seem like there's this culture where, you know, if you're not completely 100% on board, you're gone. And so I think this is not the first time this has happened. And I agree with Tom. You know, there are Father Flager put out a statement on behalf of a bunch of community groups saying we're very concerned about this.
Yeah.
We're coming up on the summer. They trusted Gatewood. They thought that Gatewood did have a role in this violence reduction, and they want more answers. They're aldermen that want more answers, too, that they don't believe the mayor can just skate by saying, well, he's gone, and we don't talk about personnel matters.
And Gatewood was very visible. And kind of the notable thing is, right, Johnson's shifted this office a bit, but under Lightfoot, there was a similar office. Gatewood has stuck around in this role, whereas with Lightfoot, she found a really hard time threading the needle, right? In this interesting role of you're dealing with the mayor's office, you're dealing with the police department, you're dealing with community groups, And Lightfoot had a hard time, I think, finding the right person to do that. And it looked like the mayor had a real ally and someone he really trusted doing that kind of critical role.
But then also bridge the divide between the public safety community and the mayor. When there's significant divides, like on ShotSpotter. You know, Gatewood was trusted by both sides, and Gatewood was also on his transition team. Like, he's been there with the mayor from the beginning, so why now?
Yeah, definitely more to dive into there. Really wanted to quickly get in the this hike in the Chicago hotel tax, which will soon become the highest in the nation. Alders approved a tourism improvement district that raises the tax on hotel rooms within that district to 19%. Julie, why do Alders want our hotels to have the highest tax in the country?
This is an interesting one. Chicago raising taxes may not seem like the most shocking headline in the world, but we already had a very high hotel tax.
Dog barks.
Yes. And now we will have 19% hotel tax, the highest in the nation, all to market our city and our hotel business. Now, one might think that if you want more people to come to Chicago and stay in hotels or companies to book conferences and conventions, you might not want to make it more expensive for them to do so. So this is a bit of a head scratcher. So I think that, you know, we'll have to see how this plays out. This kind of thing is definitely going to be a turnoff to cities that are booking large conventions. It's not insignificant when you're comparing it to other cities. So we'll have to see how this one plays out.
Absolutely.
Can I just ask one question, though? Because, like, the hotel tax, that's how we fund the public part of financing stadiums. And we've all gone around saying, well, not a cent of public money for the Bears or for the White Sox or whatever. But we're going to raise this part of the hotel tax for tourism. But they're not going to extend the hotel tax to fund a stadium. And I'm not saying I support funding the stadium publicly, but, like, why is this okay? But then, you know, the notion of, like, extending the hotel tax to help finance the Bears, to maybe keep them from leaving for Indiana, like, but that's toxic and we're never going to touch that. I don't understand that at all.
Yeah, well, put that to the city. So Tom, this feels like the beginning of a joke. You reported on a local cybersecurity expert who feds say turned out to actually be a cyber criminal. What are the details there?
Okay, so I think by now everyone has to do the trainings with their job, so we all know what a ransomware attack is, right? They've affected corporations and hospitals and government agencies, and essentially hackers take over computers and then they won't give control back until they get a ransom, an amount of money. And so there's this company in Chicago that's called Digital Mint, and it negotiates the ransoms. It's the go-between between the company and the hackers, and they figure out what the amount is and make sure it's paid, usually in cryptocurrency. So federal authorities say that an employee of this company, Digital Mint, was like essentially a wolf in sheep's clothing. So he was working with a team of people, including another person from Digital Mint, and they were conducting the hacks.
Wow.
And then he was going back and he was working on behalf of Digital Mint to negotiate how much the company was paying them. And it resulted in $75 million in payments. And there's been some convictions already, and this guy is charged. He's likely to plead guilty. So it's really a bizarre.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, then it just kind of calls into question all the trainings at work that you have to do around ransomware and who you can really trust then.
It does. And yeah, you know, those quizzes are pretty maddening, but I guess it's better than getting hacked. But yeah, this is a very strange series of events. It does call into question this whole industry, I think. Yeah. Because it's very murky. It's these companies that are getting paid handsomely, and as it turns out, this company in Chicago that initially started as a digital ATM or a Bitcoin ATM company, and the company's founder Mark Grenz had kind of positioned himself as saying, "Oh, I got out of the digital ATM business because, you know, that's an industry ripe for fraud." So they moved into this space, and so it turns out that there's these huge issues with his employees there. Yikes.
Well, sticking with technology, big tech companies are suing over Chicago's new social media tax passed in December. Julie, what are the details of the tax and the lawsuit?
So this is a new tax on social media that Mayor Johnson favored, and it will companies that are social media companies have to start paying a tax of 50 cents per user after the first 100,000 users who log on to Snapchat, Instagram, any of the other social media companies that we love so much. And city officials think that this is going to produce a big windfall for mental health programs. And their argument is, look, these companies are causing mental health issues for our young people, and we need to tax them. Other cities and states have tried to pass these kinds of measures, and usually they've been tied up in litigation or they've failed for some other way. And that's exactly what's happening here. Big tech is pushing back and saying, look, this is a First Amendment violation. You can't tax us any more than you would tax any other, you know, a newspaper company or any other company. So this looks like it's going to be a tough road for this new measure.
Yeah, for sure. Turning to education, Paris, there continues to be drama at the Chicago Board of Education over their ongoing search for a school CEO. And you actually got caught up in some of that drama. Can you fill us in on that?
Sure. Well, in terms of the search for a CEO, I mean, this process has been, I mean, this has kind of gone under the radar a little bit. Obviously, the education reporters have done a nice job kind of documenting all this, but the process to find a new CPS superintendent, it's been a mess. I mean, there was a search firm that the board hired and retained to do this, and then they parted ways basically because they did not agree with who the mayor and board president Sean Hardin wanted to be a finalist. So the board finally settles on three finalists, and then this week we learned from the Tribune that one of the finalists has backed out. So now there's just two finalists, and one of those is the current interim CEO, Macklin King, and then the other finalist, someone named Narcisse, I think, how you pronounce it, from New Orleans or from Louisiana. And what doesn't make sense about any of this is that this board is only going to exist for another year. And then per state law, the new fully elected school board takes place. So why are they in such a hurry to install a superintendent when there's going to be a whole new set of bosses in a year? And what it screams of is Mayor Johnson and the CTU want to make sure they cement their control over the schools before the elected school board comes in, which is antithetical to what they fought for, because they were central to lobbying the state to pass a law to make it an elected school board because they wanted more democracy. Yeah. So I mean, none of it makes any sense. And then the part you mentioned about me is that Sean Hardin, the board president, retained a law firm to investigate who leaked information to reporters, including a reporter here,
Sarah Karp.
And then to me, the crime, according to whoever this leaker must have been, was they leaked to me the notice of a public meeting that the board was going to have where they went and raised property taxes. I'm kind of at a loss here. I mean, of all the things to get mad about, a meeting which by law must have public notice to it. A reporter found out about it, and Sean Hardin, they're spending tens of thousands of taxpayer money on a law firm to find out who leaked it. And guess what? They're not going to find it because, like, they asked me. The law firm contacted me and said, we would like you to participate. We think you have information relevant to our investigation. And I said, sure. Yes, when pigs fly. And, I mean, first of all, I said, can you tell me how much you're charging the school district for this investigation? And they didn't answer that. So, you know, that was the extent of our correspondence. But none of this makes any sense.
Right.
And again, it does scream, it goes back to the firing of Gatewood. It screams of a mayoral administration trying to control everything they can when a lot of things are out of their control right now. And I'll go back to when you fought for more democracy, you fought for an elected school board. It's going to take its seat in over a year. What are we doing here trying to rush? I mean, and one could make the argument that qualified candidates don't want this job, because why would you want this job when you're going to have a whole new set of bosses in a little over a year, and with all, amid all this turmoil at the schools?
Right. I mean, it's a long list of school CEOs in the past, I don't know, 10 years? It's a very long list.
Yeah, there needs to be some stability here. I mean, you're right. There's, you know, going back to Barbara Bird Bennett, who was convicted of, you know, kickbacks and stuff. Like, when is this school district going to have stability amid a financial terrible situation, you know, where right. they've... And this is what the mayor wants: a superintendent that will commit to borrowing more money, basically, to make ends yeah. meet. And so it's a very chaotic situation.
Yeah, for sure. Well, from one board to another, Tom, the mayor will soon have to choose who he wants on the city's police oversight board. One of the six nominees is Anjanette Young. Remind us who she is.
So she was the subject of this just like dehumanizing botched police raid in 2019, and it was captured on video. She was nude. They had raided the wrong home based on bogus information. And this was like, you know, this set off this real political firestorm, and it did result in significant reforms to how they execute search warrants, or the police departments that execute search warrants. But Young has just been this crusader, and the crusader for even stricter reforms, including a ban on what are called no-knock warrants. And so she's been really visible. She advocates for other victims of police misconduct. There was another trial recently about a family that had been the victim of a wrongful raid. Anjanette was there supporting them, and she's a pretty powerful political figure. She's a really powerful speaker. So this is pretty interesting that she might get onto this panel, which is the Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability. And yeah, the mayor will have to pick and name a handful of new panelists, and then it'll have to get city council approval.
Yeah. And now we're coming out down here to the end. So I just want to hear from each of you. What are you looking ahead to next week? The elections are now behind us. What do you have coming up this week, Julie?
Well, this week, the Times published an investigation of Cesar Chavez, which was a really remarkable investigation by my colleague Manny Fernandez. And the fallout has been a national story, and it could also be a Chicago story. We have schools named after Cesar Chavez. I think that there will be some decisions to be made about whether to keep his name on the school. Just yesterday, CPS said that they were beginning to ask for input from parents, from the school community, about what should happen.
Yeah, we'll be on the lookout for that. Tom, just a few seconds.
Yeah, in my world, there's two ongoing investigations that we're interested in. There was a freshman at the Loyola University of Chicago who was killed seemingly randomly on the lakefront earlier this week. We're going to be looking out to see if any arrests are made there. We also had a person of interest in this fatal fire that killed firefighter Michael Altman earlier this week, taken into custody, taken in for questioning. So we'll see if charges are brought there as well. Those are kind of the two cases, the heater cases in the public safety world right now.
Thank you. Paris?
Bear quickly. Stadium. Are lawmakers in Springfield going to get it over the goal line here? And how patient are the Bears going to be waiting for Illinois to do something? They're down there right now. Yeah. Maybe debating it right now. How patient are the Bears going to be before they just say, all right, Indiana, you're rolling out the red carpet. We're now the Hoosier Bears.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guffman. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.